Merry Christmas, everyone. Thank you. I hope you had a wonderful time with family the last few days. This is the last Sunday of 2014. Can you believe it? Most amazing is that in the bulletin where we do that little number, it goes up every week. You're all checking it now. I actually got number 52 for today, which means I did it right. And in my 9 years at this church, I think that is the first time. AD can confirm that. Yes. Took me 9 years, but I got there. Yes. Well, being the last Sunday of 2014, I want to complete my New Year's resolution for this year. And I have suffered. I have failed to do this so many times. You know, I did it my first Sunday back from sabbatical, and then promptly the next week, forgot again. And for those of you who have not been here on a regular basis, if you're wondering what is he talking about, my New Year's resolution was each week to remind you of your status as God's blessed children. Because throughout the week, we get so many messages that say we are not good enough, we're not smart enough, we're not holy enough, whatever it might be. People want you to think that better is possible if only you buy something or do something or they're better than you are. And today, I just want to reassure you with the words that Jesus heard when he was baptized, as he came up from the water. I adapt it for you. Stanton Mennonite Church, you are God's children, his beloved. And with you, God is well pleased. Whew. Now, if I forget it next week, it's a new year. It's all right. New Year's resolution's over. So we have a lot of routines, like trying to remind you of your blessed status. A lot of routines and rituals in our life and in the church. And one of the rituals that we experience as our extended family is that we always get together with Sonia's family, my in-laws, well, quite regularly, but also especially around Christmas to open Christmas presents. That's normal, right? People do that. That's where the normalness stops with the in-laws. Now, they do a few things differently than what I am used to, things that are different than the way they were when I grew up. And one of the things that they do different is that every year they exchange stockings. You know, the stockings were hung by the chimney with care, that kind of thing. They have the traditional stockings, and in those stockings, they fill it with little small gifts, small things with, you know, not very expensive kind of gifts. I guess you could put a small diamond ring or ruby brooch or something like that in there. Hasn't happened yet for me. They have all these small little gifts, and they put in the stockings, and everybody goes around the room, and you open one gift, and then the next person opens theirs, even though it's the exact same gift as the person before, and you know what you're getting. It's like, I know what that is. That's going to be a Hershey's bar. You go around the group. Everybody opens their presents, and this year I got a lot of mints and gum. Mints and gum. That means somebody in the Miller family wants to give me a very subtle message and tell me, Kevin, you have bad breath. So I came to Sonia with my thesis. I said, Sonia, I believe your family is trying to tell me something. And she says, no. I suggested that to them. So yes, somebody was trying to tell me I have bad breath. Not only do they have this exchange of Christmas stockings, there's also a bit of a ritual of the exchanging of gag gifts. Okay, it's always one person thinks that he or she, whoever it might be, has to give somebody else something that is totally useless other than for a little bit of a giggle, right? You know, it's not something that's got really any value other than maybe to embarrass somebody or to annoy the rest of us. The person who generally gives that gift is my father-in-law. Last year, he gave my mother-in-law something like this. I know it's kind of hard to read there. This is a plush singing reindeer. And if you push the little spot right here on the hand, it will sing. Can you read the words? Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. You know the song? I won't sing it for you today. Marlene's like, I don't know. You want me? You. What I'm hearing you say, because I don't hear too well, is you've never heard it before and you want us to sing it. Is that? Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. It says by Dr. Emo. I didn't realize the guy had his PhD, but he's a very well-educated minstrel or something. Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. You push the button, the deer does a little jig and sings the song over and over and over again. And my father-in-law, he thinks this is hilarious, because my mother-in-law thinks it's terrible, kind of in the same boat as Marlene is in. So this just makes him do it all the more. I don't think he really gets that much of a kick out of pushing the button and seeing it dance. But when my mother-in-law reacts to it, it just makes him do it again. Now, my children are ages 4 and 2. And when they see Grandma recoil like that, and they see her make the faces that Marlene made a little bit ago to me, when they see her reaction, they see Grandpa's reaction, they get into it as well, and they want to push the button over and over and over again. So this new ritual at the Miller household is to put this reindeer, this singing reindeer, on continuous loop in the background during our Christmas program and Christmas activities. So this year I decided to start a new ritual. It's a new game that I like to call Hide the Singing Reindeer. And guess what, folks? I am winning. I hid that thing like 2 weeks ago. They still have not found it. I know my mother-in-law just realized how to listen to sermons online, and she'll hear it now. It is hidden in a cupboard right next to their tree. And they have not yet found it. Seriously, 2 or 3 weeks into this game of hiding the reindeer. But these are the rituals and routines of our Christmas time with the in-laws. And I'm sure each and every one of us has some sort of set of rituals and routines at Christmas time. Maybe it's come to Virginia to see the in-laws. Or, as Sonia and I are about to do, go to Ohio and visit them, where she will make fun of the way my family does things. We all have these rituals and routines, and it's not just about Christmas, it's about other things throughout the year. Does anybody have a birthday routine, something that you do every year for someone's birthday? Maybe go to a particular restaurant, or give a certain gift, or sing a certain song, right? Okay, nobody sings the birthday song. I guess that's just my family that sings Happy Birthday. All right. Maybe you have a ritual or routine at the end of the school year when the children finish up and they get their grade cards. You do something. We went to Chuck E. Cheese as a kid. Whenever we got all A's, you could take your grade card and you get free tokens at Chuck E. Cheese and some really awful pizza. You all have these rituals and routines about anniversaries, birthdays, and holidays, things that we do every year as a way to enhance our experiences. But sometimes these rituals, these routines, they don't enhance them, but they become a hindrance. Sometimes we just do the rituals and routines without giving it any thought. And we just do them because that's what we've always done. And I think our text today shows the power of rituals and routines. And we're going to explore a little bit what I'm calling the rituals and routines of hope. So when we get into the scripture for today, we find that Jesus' parents are taking him to the temple. And this is found in Luke's gospel. And Luke, he doesn't seem to be too worried about the details of this. And what he does is he's kind of mashing up two different rituals, putting it all in one section. And if you don't really know what's going on, it's hard to really figure it out. So in verse 22, we find that it says that they went to the temple for purification rites, as it was demanded in the law of Moses. Now, Mary was a woman, and it says in the book of Leviticus, chapter 12, which I know we are all very familiar with. We have that memorized, right? Bible quizzing time. Recite. No. Leviticus chapter 12 gives all of these somewhat unique, that's a nice way of saying, strange purification rites and rituals. And it says in Leviticus chapter 12 that if a woman gives birth to a boy, that she is to go to the temple and make offerings for the purification of her body. It says, if you give birth to a boy 1 week after the birth of that child, you go to the temple and you offer one live lamb on the temple altar. Now, strangely enough, if you give birth to a female, you are unclean for 2 weeks. A male, 1 week. A female, 2 weeks. I don't know why, but that's the way it is. I could make some joke, but it wouldn't be very very kind. Girls are just dirty. I mean, I don't know. Here it is. Jesus is obviously a boy. So it's 1 week after his birth, and they come to the temple to make this sacrifice for purification of Mary's body, to make her clean again. And as I said, it says in Leviticus that you offer one lamb for this ritual sacrifice. But it also gives a bit of an opportunity. If you don't have the money to buy a lamb, because I guess lambs are kind of expensive, if you don't have that kind of fund available to you, you can offer to pigeons or to doves. So that is going on in this chapter. But we go to verse 23, and it says that Jesus is going there to be consecrated. To be consecrated means to make holy, to set aside something for God. Now we find in Exodus chapter 13 this little passage. It says in chapter 13 verse 2, this is God speaking, "Consecrate to me every firstborn male. The first offspring of every womb among the Israelites belongs to me, whether human or animal." Now the reason that this is in there, this is after the Exodus event, after the Israelites come out of captivity in Egypt. God has just led his people through the number of plagues, and God protected the Israelites. And the last of the plagues was that God killed the firstborn child and firstborn animal in all of Egypt. But if you were an Israelite, you put the blood of a lamb on your doorpost, and God passed over your house. That's why they call it Passover, creative name, right? So God passed over the house of the Israelites, saving their firstborn child and their firstborn animal. So as they come out of Egypt, God then makes this command, "The firstborn child of yours, since I passed over them in Egypt, they are now to be consecrated to me." And what that means is the firstborn animal out of every womb is to be slaughtered for God. And the firstborn male child out of every womb is to be given in service of the temple. That firstborn male child is to be the priest, the one that performs these ritualistic sacrifices and prayers and other things in the temple. Now we know that didn't last very long because these firstborn children, they didn't live up to God's expectations. So God soon passed that responsibility on to a family of Israelites known as the Levites. But in order for God to free those people from this responsibility, free them from their role in the church, in the temple, the people had to buy them back from the service. And this is a ritual known as the Pidyon HaBen. Everybody say, Pidyon HaBen. Now, how many of you were thinking just then that in Kevin's 3 months of sabbatical leave, how much did you miss learning Hebrew and Greek, yeah? 17 of you just raised your hands. Thank you so much. You didn't know that if you're sitting in the front, all the people behind you are just like, yeah. The Pidyon HaBen, it literally means the redemption of the firstborn. What the people are doing is they are buying back their child from service to the temple, which is awkward to me because my parents paid money for me to serve the church. But anyways, this is the buying back of the child from the service to the temple. And it seems like a sign of a strange practice to us today, especially when you consider that this is still done in very Orthodox Jewish families. It's still a practice that goes on. On the 31st day after a male son is born, again, it's only the firstborn son, on the 31st day after the child is born, the parents take this male child to the temple, and they have these things. This right here is, there's 5 silver coins. It's hard to see there. But they give 5 silver coins to the Levites. Again, the people who are the priests in the temple. And the Levites have a series of phrases that they say over the child. They pray over the child. The parents respond with some things. The Levites sign these documents right here. And then they give the coins to the Levites. A few more prayers are said. The child is blessed. And then the parents are given these silver coins back. And they take the child home. Now, there's a lot of things we could say about the Pidyon HaBen. And we could just keep saying Pidyon HaBen because it's fun to say. Well, we can say a lot of things about this redemption of the firstborn. I think there's a lot of parallels between what we see here with the firstborn Redeemer and the birth and life and death of Jesus Christ. And I think it would be a wonderful thing to explore as we get closer to Easter. But today on Christmas, on the Sunday after Christmas, I want to focus more on the childhood aspect of this ritual and routine. But I think many of you caught that it's somewhat strange, this routine, that when the parents take this child to the Levite and they give them those 5 silver coins, is it not kind of strange that they give the coins back then? Now, I wonder, what does that mean to us today? What does it mean that the Levites give the money back to the parents after they give those 5 silver coins? And the first thing I thought of is, this is the first example of somebody taking something after Christmas and getting a refund, right? Wow! It's been a busy week. The jokes aren't as good as usual. I'm sorry. You don't think of really good jokes as you're listening to Grandma got run over by a reindeer over and over again. No. So what is this about? Why do they give it back? I think it shows that the Israelites, when they go through this exchange, they don't really think they're buying their son back from the temple. They're doing this as a ritual, as a routine, as a way to remind them of what God has done for them and through them and what God will continue to do for them in the future. This is a reminder that God led their people out of captivity in Egypt, that God protected them through their wandering years in the wilderness, that God provided food for them when they were hungry. It's not really about a transaction. Here's some money, give me my child back. It's about saying God has done all of this for us, and we need to do something to remember to give God thanks. That is what Mary and Joseph are doing in the temple that day. So we see a number of rituals and routines in Jesus' family. We see them in just this passage. We see them going to the temple for the cleanliness ritual. We see them going for the Pidyon HaBen ritual. You go a few more verses, you see that they go to the temple again to celebrate a holy day. And they forget Jesus there, but that's another story for another time. So all of these things, Jesus' family participates in these rituals and routines, again, meant to draw them closer to God. Remember what God has done for you, for us, that God is with us. Now, Jesus didn't stay a little baby. He grew into a man and he got to make his own decisions. And we see through Jesus' life that sometimes he chose not to participate in the rituals of his family. We see at times he doesn't completely reject things like the Sabbath ritual of keeping the Sabbath, of not working on the seventh day. But he kind of pushes back from the way some people perform these rituals because they forget about the purpose behind them. He pushes back on some of those cleanliness laws, especially as he talks with the Pharisees and the scribes. He says things like this. He says, and this isn't a good sign when it starts out like this, "Woe to you!" If you're ever in a conversation with Jesus and he starts with "woe to you," not a good sign. "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites!" Not a good sign also. "You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisees, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside also will be clean." He's pushing back against these empty rituals, saying, why do you do these things and not worry about the purpose behind them? You're just walking through the motions and you're not drawing yourself closer to God. Some other people, it's not just Jesus that's critical of these empty rituals and routines. People like Paul and Isaiah call them filthy rags. If you've been around the church for a while, you know that this is actually kind of softening what the actual text says. What the guys are actually saying is your empty rituals, they're like menstrual rags to God. I could go a step further, but you're getting the idea. It's like something that's just, yeah, what is that? God doesn't want those empty rituals, empty routines. But we'd be making a mistake if we thought Jesus was against rituals and routines. Because Jesus actually starts a few new ones as well. On the night before Jesus was to be crucified, he met with his disciples in the upper room. And he gathered them around the table and they broke bread and they drank from the cup together. And as they did these things, Jesus said to them, "Do this in remembrance of me." Jesus not only rejected certain rituals and routines, he started some new ones as well. So I think we'd be wrong to say that Jesus is against rituals and routines. He's against the empty ones that just are there for what purpose? For reflecting upon themselves, maybe. He's about these rituals and routines that call us back to God, call us to remember what God has done for us. what God is doing through us and what God will do with us in the future. So I look around this sanctuary. We still have a few flickering candles. This one's burned out, so we're obviously getting near the end of Advent. There's a few back there in the window. Bernie was a little upset. Her candle burned out early. It was John. The candles are starting to burn down. We're at the end of Advent. If you grew up in a traditional Mennonite background or an old school Anabaptist church like I did, you probably weren't familiar with the practice of Advent and Lent. And this was relatively new to me when I started attending a progressive MCUSA congregation. So it's new to me as well. But I didn't understand, why do we do these things? I just lost another candle. Look at that. Why do we do these things? I think that the idea behind Advent and Lent is in part because Christmas and Easter have become somewhat empty rituals for the church. They've lost some of their meaning. When Christmas becomes more about Santa Claus and reindeers and presents, and Easter becomes more about the Easter bunny and chocolate, not that that's a bad thing, chocolate's good. When those things become more about those things and less about Jesus' birth, Jesus' death and resurrection, then maybe these become empty rituals in the church. So I think we, as traditionally non-liturgical churches, are going back toward these practices of Advent and Lent because we see within them what these were meant to be, what Christmas was meant to be, what Easter was meant to be. They're reminders of what God has done, what God is doing, and what God will do. So in the last couple of minutes this morning, I want to go back to that story of the Pidyon Haben. I want to look at some of the rituals and routines of the church that bring us in line with what God's will is. Things that help us to build hope within us for a better future, for God's kingdom to come and God's will to be done. So I'm going to call them the rituals and routines of hope. And the first one's going to be kind of a covertly theological concept, something that you maybe haven't really thought of from the perspective of a church. And the other one's very explicitly churchy, very explicitly theological. The first one is the baby shower. How many of you have ever been to a baby shower? I am glad that I am not the only male here, because it's, unfortunately, this is a very gender-specific thing. So if you aren't familiar with a baby shower, maybe you should get familiar. It's a church thing. A baby shower, it's a beautiful thing. When somebody in the church is going to have a child for the first time, when they are pregnant, as the time draws near for them to give birth to this child, we, the church, often throw them a little party. We have a baby shower. So whether it's in the house or in the church, we open up a space and people come together to do very theological things, even though you may not think of them theologically. The first thing about a baby shower that I think is theological is the fact that we get together. We come together as a community, people that are scattered around the county. We come together, set aside anything else that we might be doing, to come around this one person, this one family, and say, we want to be there to support you. We want to be there to show you our love and appreciation for you and desire to help you with this child. The next theological thing behind a baby shower is that we participate in the community of goods. If you come to a baby shower, you bring a gift, right? You either share financially, you give money or a gift card, or you give something that you know will be of value to that person. You bring a onesie, a binky, a bottle, a bib, something like that. It has to start with a B. Binky, bottles, and bibs at the baby shower. So you bring these things and you give them to the family to be. And as I've been in a couple of these baby shower situations, the people then sit around and they share stories. And at first listen, it seems a little awkward, because to this young woman who is now, 8, 9 months pregnant, very much with child, sitting there listening to these stories from these other mothers, people that have gone before her, they hear stories about, oh, I was in labor for 5 hours with my Ethan, right? Oh, 5 hours. And somebody else has to do better than that. 5 hours? Are you kidding me? I was in labor for 12 hours straight with our Frederick. And there's always that one person that comes out of nowhere. Are you kidding me? 12 hours? That sounds like a vacation. I was in labor for 1977. That was a year. So there's all these stories that go around. And it's like, what? that's not encouraging, is it? And then other people are telling stories. My child, oh, he didn't sleep for the first 2 months. And then someone else has to top that. 2 months, my child's 2 years old. He's still not sleeping through the night. Someone else says, my son, he's moved out of the house. He's still up in the middle of the night, keeping his family awake. All these stories. And it's just like, what in the world? We're trying to encourage the woman, not scare her, right? But if you think about it, what's going on there? All these people that have come before, this great cloud of witnesses, is saying, we've been where you are, and we've made it through. It hasn't been easy, but gain some hope from knowing that we were able to make it, and you will be able to make it through too. A ritual of hope. And the other one, also involving a child that I want to mention here this morning, is baby dedications. In the church, we participate in a number of rituals and routines. Baptism, communion, so many things of this nature. But probably my favorite one to do is baby dedications. And we've not done one of these for a while. But you've probably, most of you have seen me do this at some point or another. It's very theological. The parents come up to the front of the church. I take the child from them and we read some words back and forth and commit our lives to raising this child as best as we can in the ways of Jesus Christ. And I always am very intentional. You remember what I do for the children? I always have space up here in the front row and invite the children to come up and say, will you be a guide to this child? Will you help them? Will you be a good example to that child in the ways of Jesus Christ? And you as the congregation, you are not exempt from this. I always have something for you to say as well. Will you be there for these parents? Will you guide them? Will you give them advice when they need it? Will you give them funds or babysitting as they need these helping, these ways of being helped? Will you be there for this family? This is about community. This is about supporting somebody in their time of excitement and joy. And then I always take the child and I hold them in my arms and I walk up and down the aisles of the sanctuary, introducing that child to you, maybe for the first time. Gives you a chance to reach out and grab those little toes, to feel those little fingers, to make eye contact with those baby blue eyes for the first time. And I remember, I was just thinking the other day, when I had Amir Strickland, I dedicated him here, and I got to about the third row on this side, and Papa Friesen grabbed the kid out of my arms and gave him a big smooch right on the forehead and held him for like 10 minutes. And I'm like, I got 2.5 minutes of music here on this track left, and after that, I think it's like She's a Brick House or something like that coming on, so can you hurry it up? You laugh, but it's true. But all of these things are meant to draw us into the life of this family. It's about becoming one in Christ, one body, one flesh. We work together to make this world more like Jesus wanted it to be. So why do we get so gaga? Why do we get so goo-goo over these babies as we walk them around the church and hold them and grab their little toes? And who would grab the toes of an adult? Nobody. But you grab the toes of a baby for some reason. Maybe it's pre-athletes, but I don't know. But why do we do these things? And I think the reason is, and it's time to get serious, the reason why we get so excited about babies is because they've got a clean slate. This baby's never called anybody a bad name. They've never been racist. They've never spat at somebody. They've never made fun of somebody's weight or their hair color or their eyes. They've never mocked another person. They're innocent. They have this blank slate, this clean slate. And we know that they can be almost anything, you know, with some limitations. They can be almost anything. This may be the next Mother Teresa to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked. This may be the next Martin Luther King Jr. to bring justice to an entire group of oppressed people. This child may cure cancer. It may find life on Mars. We don't know. But when we look into those baby blue eyes, we realize that we don't know what those eyes will see, what those hands will touch or do, or what that mouth will say, the ears will hear. And we know that there's so much possibility and so much hope for that child. When Mary and Joseph brought Jesus to the temple that day for the Pidyon HaBen, when they dedicated, consecrated him to God, they had high hopes as well. and Anna and Simeon, when they saw this child, they realized that this child would change the course of the world as we know it. It is our hope, our desire, that by continuing these rituals, these practices of the church, that we too are remembering not only what God has done, but what God is doing, and how God will move through all of us and through the littlest of us to bring about God's kingdom here on earth. Amen.